Today I'm interviewing Noel Sutherland. Today is the 23rd of July, and the first question, Noel, is date of birth.
31/12/20.
And where were you born, Noel?
Oh, in Palmerston, Otago, yeah.
And your mother and father, what did they do in Palmerston?
No, he was a fat land buyer.
So he was associated with farming?
Well, he had been all his life.
And your grandparents, where did they come from?
I think they were born in New Zealand, but the great-grandparent, he came from Scotland, the northern Scotland, and to some extent the Sutherlands are regarded as the South Norwegians.
Right.
Or were, the Vikings, that sort of. They weren't very successful, and they haven't been all that successful ever since.
Your childhood was spent in Palmerston South?
That's right, yes. I spent primary and up to fifth form, and I can remember the time when we had to get 15 people to play football, rugby football. We had to use every male that was in the from the third form up to the fifth form.
So what school was that?
That was the Palmerston District High School.
So when you left high school, you then went to university?
No, I went to... I spent 2 years in Waitaki as a boarder when my father was indisposed. Yes.
So then when did you join the department?
Oh, well, joined the department after the war. University, I went to Canterbury for a couple of years, and I got half a degree. Then I joined up with the armed forces because everybody else had joined up with them. I went down to the barracks in Christchurch because I wanted to join the CYC, the Canterbury Yeomanry Cavalry, because I liked horses. And little did I know that they turned out to be machine gunnings. And that was quite different. But by the same token, the bloke looked at me and he said, "I know you." He said, "You're wasting your time coming in here because we're not taking anybody with flat feet." And that's the way that one happened. So then I thought I'd better see if I can join somewhere where flat feet are not so needed. So I joined the Air Force.
Okay, well, would you like to then work our way through the Air Force, where you did your training and so forth?
We were the first course to go through Rotorua. Previously, they'd been at Levin. And nobody was going to tell me what to do. I was not a person who was used to taking orders from someone who knew less about it than I did, I thought. And we had one occasion when we had a weekend leave, and coming back into camp, we had to be in by 2300 hours. And there were two or three of the lads who'd actually got married before they joined up. Well, we had a long passage, and they were in the process of progressively taking up the carpet from the long passage and everywhere else. I sort of was observing this a bit. Oh, I got there about 10 to 11. And you had to go just round the corner, and then that's where you signed in. Well, I got round the corner, and by God, who was there? The station warrant officer. And I thought, well, he's wasting his time with me, but I'm on plenty of time. Well, I was pretty close to it. But the other jokers, there's two or three of them, they came running down the passage, full tilt, just to experience the SWO had taken his pen out and his watch on, and 11 o'clock was striking, on the radio, or it was 11 o'clock, and he'd drawn the line, and he put whoever it was, he said, "You are late. You are AWOL, and you'll be penalised." And he booked the three of them, and he wrote them down as being AWOL. Well, those jokers spent the next fortnight on the parade ground at the end of the day, lugging a pack around a square that we had.
Were they trying to enrol?
Of course they enlisted, but they had to obey the rules. But not, God, I had to alter my bloody opinion there very, very, very quickly indeed. That was an object lesson to me. Yes, worked quite well.
So then, once you'd become enlisted, where did you go to train?
Well, we had initial training was down at Tyree, and one or two interesting stories there. It was open to the Nor'wester. The Nor'wester could blow, and in fact, on this occasion, it was blowing at the same airspeed as the Tiger Moth did in calm weather. So we were, the instructor had sent someone up solo for the first time. He got worried that the boy would not understand what was what. So he went up and he wiggled his wings, and that was the indication to follow me. He came down and he landed at the same speed as the Nor'wester, and the ground crew formed a circle. It didn't have to be very big for a Tiger Moth. And as soon as he touched the ground, they rushed in and grabbed a hold of the wing and the tail. That held it down until they got it onto a tow rope towed it away. And then the student came in and did exactly the same thing, and that was perfect. Thought that was very, very good work. He'd figured things out, and he knew what he was doing.
So from there, where did you do further training in New Zealand, or did you go, was it to Canada?
No, we went straight from Tyree over to Canada. But Tyree was interesting. We had to get a pass to get out every night, and it was a bit of corrugated iron or flat iron. It was scratched with a number on it, and you had to hand that in when you came back over the railway line the next day, because you were actually on the next property. But if you left the door open of the two-man hut that you were in, the sheep used to get in and they fouled the floor, and it was nice and quiet and no wind. We were given an issue of 9 blankets each. 4 of them were to go around the wall because the hut wasn't windproof. We finally gave up because it was up till about 10 o'clock in the morning when some of the blokes appeared on the flights because they slept in. You couldn't hear anything. You couldn't hear the siren go because the wind was in the wrong direction. We had mud up to our knees just about, because we had to walk through a ploughed paddock, or at least it had been ploughed and was in green feed at the time, and the stock were being moved through it. It was hopeless.
So then you moved on to Canada from Tyree.
I pulled in at Calgary. Yes, oh, the trip up the Pacific was interesting because every night we had to turn all the lights out or blinds down in the train that we were in, and we had a bloke looking after us, and he had a rhythm. All the lights down, all the blinds down, grab your pillows and make up your beds as well as you can, and good night. Yes, they were very conscious of the fact that the that the Japanese were quite close to the Californian coast. Up that line, we called in at a place called Eugene, which is just short of Seattle. There was some Australians ahead of us, and they were in different coloured uniform. And the train pulled into the station, and the university students, for morning tea, they used to come down with sandwiches and coffee for the boys that were going through. Well, that was great. Once they spotted these Australians in a different colour, they had a boiler suit, which was ideal for the job. And, who are these blokes over here? And the fellow next to me said, they're English-speaking Japanese prisoners of war. But he said, they speak slightly differently to us. And who got the sandwiches and the coffee? The New Zealanders. And we were escorting them through to Canada. So we did pretty well out of that lot.
So in Canada, then you would have got on with your real training.
We were on
single engine biplane?
Yeah, twin engine. And they had, going into the compound, they had a skeleton of two of these airplanes that had been burnt with a warning, do as you're supposed to do. And we didn't take anybody notice of it. But what happened was that there was some guys ahead of us, and they'd come in on a Sunday, and there wasn't very much security around, and they wandered around, and all they picked on these airplanes. So they climbed up, got into the cockpit. One notice said, do not touch this. So that's the first thing they touched. And they gave it a pull, and it fired off flares. And they sent a light to the airplane that was next to them, and the next one. And by that time, the ground crew had got a whiff of it, and they put them out. So they had these skeletons.
Yes.
At the door, it says, please do as you're supposed to do. Yeah.
Just a point, Noel, what age were you when you were in Calgary?
Oh, I was about 20, 22, 23. So it was interesting at Calgary because one or two things. One was the Chinook, which was their nor'wester, and it cut a line through the snow. We arrived there when the first of the Christmas snows had arrived. It cut a line almost half a chain wide. Bare ground on one side and 100% snow on the other. Just about as neat as that. And the lines, the longitude and the latitude lines were as you find on a global map. They were ran parallel to the direction. And obviously, the longitudinal lines started to converge when you got up onto the north side of the equator. And up by Canada, they were converging quite a bit. So when you swung your compass, you had to make sure that you are in the middle of that line to take a reading, and that's what we did.
So how long did you train in Calgary?
We put in about 70 hours on the airplane for flying. Oh, one or two experiences that we had too. None the least of which was that you had to put in something like 70, 75 hours. And when you got over 60, you felt you knew it all anyway. And you were just told to put in time. do a certain number of landings and takeoffs. I remember a mate of mine from the west coast of New Zealand. He was doing the numbers game a bit, and he said, "Oh, I've finished now." And the control tower came up, they said, "No, you've got another hour and a half to fill in." And he swore at them, and they came back and they said, "We admire your spirit, but we don't admire your language." And that knocked him back a bit.
Well, these aeroplanes, how many flew in them? A pilot? Did you have a navigator?
You got to a stage where you went solo, and then you did certain simple things, and then you got more complicated. I should have said, when it came to a slow roll, in which you really had to drive the aeroplane to its capability, and then the knowledge that you had things at right angles to each other, upside down and left and right. I used to do that, and you had to do that in the aerobatics, which was done above 4,000 feet. So that if you made a mess of it, you still had time to get out of the aeroplane in a parachute. And that was the minimum height. Well, I was going for my clearance from Tyree, and the instructor was sitting in the front seat, and the Tiger Moth, you know, I used to always lose about 1,000 feet to 1,500. And I thought, good God, what are we doing now? He said, you haven't done a slow roll. Oh, well, why not do it now? And we were at 1,000 feet, and I thought, oh my God, that's that. Well, I thought also he would pull me out of it. Well, I got so bloody scared that I had the nose pointed up all the time, and of course that's the trick that you use, because you keep climbing, and because you're losing height and then you're gaining height. It turned out to be bang on, and he passed me as being fit and well. And good Lord, I was the most scared guy he'd come across.
This is before you went to Calgary?
Before I went to Calgary. Yes.
Where did you go from there? Did you go to Europe then?
We went on leave. The final leave to go from Halifax across to the UK. Some of us, six in New Zealanders, and there were six Australians too, we got to Halifax, and they didn't want to know us. They sent us down to New Brunswick to do an OTU, which is only normally done in the UK. And at the OTU, we crewed up. And that meant that you had to pick on a wireless operator, a navigator for a start, and then a rear gunner, and finally a NAV-B, a bomb aimer. At that stage, the OTU stood for the Operational Training Unit. We got that way that we were doing not too badly, and I started to think, my gosh, when we did practice bombing, you had to come over a target and then swing to one side so the rear gunner could have a go at it as well. And we had fine aluminium powder that was dropped on the water. It gradually started to get a bit bigger and a bit bigger, but as you came across it, the closer you got to it, the more accurate your bomb or with your shooting. And I was warned that some guys, two or three courses ahead of us, They got so keen on this that they actually followed the ammunition right into the middle. They pranked, they killed themselves. I could see that sticking out a mile. But I thought, my God, I kidded myself that we were doing pretty well with an error. At a later stage in my career, we came down and I had about a 17 and a half foot error for bombing. Closer you came, the bit more accurate you got. But wait a minute, I came across the target and I thought, gee whiz, we're nice and low now, we'll blow it out of its existence. So we lined up, and just at the last minute, I realised they had a washing line around the top of the target, and at the last minute I pulled the nose up, and we had a 70-foot error. Just threw the bombs over. My God, that was a close call.
You went from New Brunswick then to England.
We got to Halifax again. From Halifax, they sent us on leave again. Well, it's the first time that I've seen a group of fellows, and there were six Australians and six New Zealanders, and we put all the money that we had on the table, and we whacked it into 12. And we had enough money to get us back to New York again, or we could have stayed on the station, or we could have gone on some other sort of gratuitous leave facility. So we decided to go back to New York. One of the blokes that I'd sort of got cobbery with, he knew the people in the mission, the New Zealand Economic and Industrial Mission in New York. And we slept in their corridor. They put us up for two or three nights at no cost. So we had that's the way we'd spent all our money in the fare down to New York and back again. But it was quite good.
So then you moved to England, did you?
Yeah. Oh, we moved back to Halifax. They said, oh, well, we're going on board. We said, well, how are we going to get there? Oh, they said, you've got a route march. So they said, well, you've got to carry your packs. At least we'll carry your packs, but you'll have to carry your overcoat and a gas mask. And we said, no, that's not on. And it was as hot as anything, because this is now coming the summer. We said, how long is the route going to be? Oh, they said, well, the army are going on first, and then you fellows, and then the officers. I said, well, wait a minute. Oh, we can only march to music. Now, this was a secret business. Mm. We had special notes for the build-up of secrecy and security. And I said, how the heck are you going to, or at least I agreed with the people who said that you're going to get an army full of troops onto a boat and march them through the main streets of Halifax, all those main streets, and to music. Everybody will hear it. Everybody will be out to have a look at it. There'll be more noise and people will be all over the place. Oh, well, we finished up with four bands, and you could just, and they all had to be in step, and we had a ball of our time. We put our chest out a wee bit, and they carried our kit bags and our gas masks and our greatcoats, and we did a march. Oh, the Queen Mary was in. Oh, that's lovely. This is a big ship, and it carried goodness knows how many troops. We got to the Queen Mary. They said, oh no, your boat's just in front. What size is this? They said, oh well, it's carried the troops over and it's French. The Louis Pasteur. And I've never known of a ship that's been more misnamed all my life. So we got down and we were on D deck because the army had taken the upper deck. On D deck, and D deck was below water level. Well, holy smoke. It was terrible. It was shocking. You could smell the blooming lower decks when you're up on the top deck. It was shocking. We didn't know, of course, at that stage that about a fortnight beforehand, the Australians that were on the same deck, they walked off the ship at 11:30 at night when the ship was supposed to sail at 12. The Australian liaison officer, he met the New Zealand liaison officer halfway down the steps. And he said, look, he said, don't bother to go down because, he said, the boys will walk off, the New Zealanders will walk off too. Well, we'd had a meeting since then and we decided to walk off at 11:45. Well, at 11:30, the boat pulled out. Yeah. Oh, my God. Yes, they got the wheeze of it. Well, you've never seen such a shamble. So the two other New Zealanders and myself, we got together and we said, well, now, we'd better see what we can do about this. I think that you got to take a time. And we've been trained to hold our breath for 90 seconds. We get as tired as we can upstairs, and then we'll go down the stairs, take a deep breath before you go down, and then get into bed and hopefully get to sleep before you wake up again, because the place was stinking. So we decided to do that. So at about 1 o'clock in the morning or so, we were still up on the main deck. We're just sort of lolling around. And then all of a sudden there was an army bloke came up. Oh, he said, oh, thank goodness, some New Zealanders. Oh, well, so Air Force. Air Force, that's right. My God, good for you. Well, he said, look, I've got no jurisdiction over the Air Force people. He said, but I would wonder if you could give me a bit of a hand. And we said, well, what for? He said, well, there's an English RAF bloke. He's up the mast and he wants to drop off. And he said, I've been asked to talk him out of getting off, but he said I'd have to arrest him. And I can't do that because I'm not in the RAF. He said it can only be done by someone who's the same rank as him and in the same defence force. He said, will you give me a hand, you three? We said, yeah, that's all right. So eventually he came down, but then this bloke went up to point him out to us, and he ran away. Well, we had a chase on our hands. He tackled him in a rugby tackle just outside the hospital facility. So this sergeant major said, well, how about you blokes looking after him? We said, wait a minute. We can't look after him for 24 hours. You'll need three blokes. In fact, you'll need more than that. Because if you go right through you've got 24 hours to fill in. And how is he going to be serviced? Or they said, well, we'll need another three. Six, that's right. Oh, well, I'm glad if I know. How do you do that? So we decided we would... Whereabouts would he go? Oh, God, yes. Where would you... Down the barracks, down below. No fear. We're not going away down there. No, no, no. By this time, Spud had opened the door and here was the hospital. 24 beds, all laid out, white sheets, no one in them. Absolutely. Oh, well, we said, at a pinch we could, but it would have to be on our conditions. Oh, yeah, that'll be all right, that's no trouble. To make a long story shorter, we finished up that we had him getting our food for us because the hospital had a priority on the queue and they could go walk straight up to the top of the queue.
Joking.
They could get whatever they wanted and then they'd wheel it back. In the last couple of days, we had him trained to get our food and bring it to us. How about that? And we did far, far better than the officer, better than anyone else.
So eventually you got to England.
We got to London, to Greenock on the Clyde. And I thought, God, this is a hell of a long trip by train. And they had a name on the side of the placard. Every station that we came to had the word Hovis. And I thought, that's funny. Oh, that's to trick the Germans because they're not going to tell you what place you're at.
That's right.
And so they all had this Hovis. I found out later that that's the name of the big bakery factory that was supplied all the bread to everywhere in the Northern England, in Scotland. So I saw Hovis, Hovis, Hovis. Oh, yeah, I thought we'd go round in a circle. But it took a long time to get down to London. Then we got to Brighton. That was interesting because they'd taken over all the sort of touristy hotel on the front, but they put bricks up over the entrance to the hotel, and that was to stop the Germans coming in at a low level and firing into the lower parts of the hotel. What we didn't realise, of course, was that they had the prime people were on the guns, and they were very, very well trained for firing. The drogue used to come across from time to time, and they'd fire at the drogue and they'd hit it more times than they missed. And what they used to do then was they realised that the gunners were fairly good, so the Germans came over at a low level and about at a distance that was a wee bit out for the gunners on the shore, they flew up here, let the bomb go, and it carried on over the top. And we learned a thing or two out of that.
When did you start your real flying in England again?
Well, that took us some time too, because they realised that down at Penfield Ridge, we trained on Venturas, which are a bit like the Hudson. We were the only ones who really were available. They said, well, we've got Venturas here. The New Zealand squadron had a Ventura squadron up there at Meepal. And, we've got a dozen or so of these aeroplanes that They could be flown, you know. Where would they fly from? Oh, well, where's the place that's not used very much? Oh, down in this New Forest, down at Stony Cross. And that's between Southampton and Plymouth. They could fly them down there. And that's where we got posted, down to the New Forest. Well, these airplanes, they'd given up flying them operationally because they were getting clobbered so much. They were suicidal. So they gave them to the people looking after us. Well, what a bigger mistake they couldn't have made, because the airplanes were clapped out to some extent, so was the aerodrome. Well, the first real fright that I got was on one occasion. You still had to keep your flying up. We were out on a cross country, just from here to there and back again, or in a triangle. And lo and behold, we got one of these aeroplanes. When we got to the distance that we were going to, about an hour out or an hour and a half out from the aerodrome, one motor started to backfire. And I thought, well, what do? I can close it down and feather it, which would cut down the drag a wee bit. On the same token, it was actually still firing, but it was about half or less power. Or do I just struggle on? And we were high enough that I worked out at the rate that we were losing height, which wasn't very much at all, that we still had enough room to get in onto the circuit at home back in the New Forest. That's what I thought. So we did that, and we came back home, and there was a flashing light, red light, that roughly identified the aerodrome, but it was mobile and it could have been anywhere within the boundary, I suppose, but it was handy. So we located that, but then there were no lights on. There was nothing else was on. What had happened was that while we were away, they'd forgotten about us, and there'd been a raid alert, and they shut down everything. Well, then we'd been away for so long that the blokes forgot about us, as I say, and they jolly well turned everything off and went back to the mess. Well, wait a minute. I got back there, and it was as black as the table here. Yes. It was a dark night, there was no moon, and there was cloud, high cloud, and it was as black as the ace of spades. Well, I stooged around for two or three circuits, and I thought, wait a minute, we've got to get out of this somehow. What do you do? Oh, we'll fire the fairy pistol, and that'll stir them up. Well, we had a fairy pistol, but we didn't have any ammunition. Oh, that was one thing. All right, we'll flash the Aulus light. We didn't have an Aulus light. We put on the landing lights. They didn't work. Now it was starting to become serious. What are we going to do? We were getting down to about 1,000 feet, which is to the circuit. And then all of a sudden, here comes a flare path lit up. Oh, thank God for that. So I thought, well, now we'll take it steady, because we can't go around again on one engine. We'll come in steady. And this was the first real fright that I got. came in, and we had a bit of power on, a little bit of power on the motor that was crooked. But I didn't like that. So we came in, and it took a very, very steady approach. We were gradually getting in. And over the fence, I spotted what this light was that I was aiming for. That was to light up a row of aeroplanes that were doing something else. The other squadron was over there. Yes. Their flight had been cancelled for the night because of the air raid earlier on, and they were unloading a row of 8 or 10 aeroplanes, Albemarles. Well, he had a choice, left or right. You couldn't land on there because you'd just kill everybody. So I took a chance and I picked the right side because that's the side that the pilot sat on. And fortunately, I almost closed my eyes because I was waiting for the prank. We were either going to land on the grass or on the tree. Fortunately, I didn't panic, but I could have. And absolutely black, you couldn't see a thing. Sure. But we were low enough that the heat from the exhaust just by the pilot side reflected on the ground. We were quite close. Just missed a forest pony. We used to send a jeep down the runway to chase the forest ponies off. And I got a reflection of the light from the exhaust on the runway. And we were on a runway. Good God. And we had a choice of goodness knows. So then as soon as I touched the ground, I jammed the brakes on. I couldn't care less whether the tires burst or what have you. So long as both of them went at the same. Well, we got to a full stop. I didn't know which way to go. No idea at all. So we sat there for about 10 minutes, a quarter of an hour. And I was catching my breath. It was beyond me. And eventually, the perimeter lights came up and we followed them around a bit. What I didn't realise was that we landed on the shortest runway that is down there. It was a calm night, and at the bottom end of that runway was a gully of about 100 to 150 feet. That was a miracle.
So then after that, when did you start your wartime flying then, proper?
Then we converted from that airplane never flew again. I couldn't get anybody to come with on an air test with me in the finish, and the chief, the engineer, I said, look, if you've changed all the plugs, you've done everything to make it sure it's okay, you've run it up, you've set it, and they spent a bit of time on it, you reckon that it's going all right? Well, let's go and have a go. And I was prepared, I was a quarter of the way down the runway, and I was prepared to stop at any time when this thing started to cough. And it wasn't until we were about halfway down the runway that it started. Exactly the same thing. And I just pulled everything off and came back in. But the crew, they wouldn't fly with me. My own ground crew wouldn't fly with me. This bloke, he stuck his neck out. But they just washed it off. Then we went to Leicester East and converted on to Stirling 3s. These were a development of the English-built bomber. It was about 1935 it first started off as a conversion from the Wellington, which it copied largely, and they had 4 inches instead of 2. The Stirling was used extensively in bombing, but not as extensively as the Lancaster, but because it had a ceiling height on it because of the width of the wings. The Lancaster could fly higher, but with slightly lesser payload. So then they decided that way back, they decided they were going to have a go at Germany. That decision was taken almost the very, very early stages of the war, and they continued making Stirlings, and then they converted those Stirlings into Mark IVs because the Stirling didn't have the height, it had the range, but it didn't have the height to keep out of trouble with the Germans. So they started making hundreds of Stirling IVs, and they had a big well in the floor that you could lift up, and the static line of the parachutists were lined up here, and the static lines behind them, they had to drop about 12 feet before the parachute was released, because if they didn't, you couldn't just jump out and pull a parachute or have a short rein on the parachute, because you had to have 12 feet clear to clear the tailplane coming across and ripping into all the parachutes.
Yes.
And so they had down below not only that, but they had really done their homework. The parachute clip would be beating up in the slipstream, taking the bottom out of the airplane, taking out of the fuselage. So they built what I call the reverse of a rugby crossbars, goalpost. So that came down, and all these straps with their very heavy
toggle on them, yes,
down here, they were held down and they were wound in just to close it down. But it was made quite a big hole in the bottom and the crew, they were responsible for handling it. I had one occasion and that was the only time that I really panicked, was we were going away to a, you could, if you stretched your neck a bit, you could see the lights of Switzerland. And we were down in there, and we normally dropped at 600 feet. And this is to supply the underground, the marquee. This was unusually rocky. Well, it was the Alps, really. And these fellows wanted the thing to be dropped at the bottom of a gully. Well, I got into this, and I thought, hell's bells, that's too bloody low, we'll not get out. It's easy enough to lose height, it's another thing to gain it. And every turn that we made, we were losing 150 feet. Well, I let it go at 1,000 feet, and that spread it over a much longer distance than normally concentrated to drop it in. Well, I had 3 goes at trying to get out of that gully, and finally, because each turn, you had 2 turns in one circle. Oh, God, it was an agony. You could have shot me down with a bow and arrow if you'd have had them, but so I got that into gear there, and finally there was a little low patch over here. I picked that, and we cleared that by about 50 feet. And
this was in a Stirling.
Yes, that's right. That's right. The way it was, as I say, you could see the Swiss lights over
here.
Yes,
yes.
That was a wee bit north of. It was on the Rhone River, not the Rhine.
Yes.
The Rhone and the Rhine both started quite close together.
And so from dropping supplies, when did you start bombing?
I had one excuse. I did one bombing trip. When the Normandy invasion was on, I took part in the early part of that. We took off at 11:30 on the 5th of June. And the invasion started just on about 12, and it was only just across the English Channel. But interestingly enough, and I haven't heard anybody else say about the conditions, the air conditions anyway, at the time, because there was a slight onshore breeze. And in fact, some of the army fellows, they got a bit sick getting in there.
Mm.
Now, for an hour before we got there, Bomber Command and the US Air Force had been bombing. There'd been a concentration on trying to knock out the Hitler's Atlantic Wall. And that stirred up so much dirt and dust and grime that when we got there, you couldn't see the ground. Now, the navigators had put a restriction on all the air movement for a fortnight before the invasion to make sure that everything was spot on. And we had an 8mm photo, of the run-in. We got to the rendezvous, and then you turned a short distance to the dropping zone. And the navigators had memorized the pinpoints on the way, and they repeated it. And they weren't allowed to talk to, only two people could talk to each other on the station. The third person ruled out.
Yes.
All right then. When we got there, you couldn't see the ground. You'd wasted your time learning all about it, and sometimes there'd be the two or three runs a day they would go through this, and the guys got it in their mind, but discussion other than with their crew, even then they knew that the discussion wasn't on. We got there, and this was a blanket. And the instruction was, if you don't drop, don't go around again. You had a one-chance opportunity. They hadn't reckoned on the dirt and grime be thrown up by the bombing and the barter use from the naval guns were firing. They'd played Mary Hill to stir it along. They thought it was another Diet, I think. Anyway, Bertie, who was magnificent at map reading, it was his hobby, it was his peacetime hobby. And he said, "Hey, Chief," he said, "we've turned quickly to the left." He said, "I know where we are." He said, "We're about 300 yards out." Now, he said, if you can drip some of that off, but of course there was only about half a minute or so in it. I reckon that we dropped within about 300, well, certainly 500 yards. Shortly afterwards, when we did our drop, we came back. I was a bit scared to go to fly too low, because I figured that I might get into someone else's trouble. And I finished up at about 10 or 12,000 feet, I think, because it was red and green, which is coming like no one's business. The churning up of the sea with the Armada approaching, it was like, as I've said before, and I've been quoted by saying it was like Cook Strait in a heavy nor'wester. It was just white, white, white. But so we got out of that one and just came back and dropped and pulled in.
What other flying did you do during the war, bombing and so forth?
Well, we had another, and this time I did panic. Did I tell you that story?
No.
We had French paratroopers on board, and they had a lieutenant or equivalent in charge of them. And we were going down to just by the Massif Central in southern France. It wasn't too south, but it was south of Paris. The orders were to drop these fellows off at a particular place. Well, we managed to get there, and first of all, cross the English Channel, no trouble, onto the French over Le Havre, and lo and behold, up comes some flak. Well, I always used to fly about 5 degrees either side of the course that we were following, because I didn't want the Germans to get the idea that we were following a course and that they're going to fire up there ahead of me and explode in front of me. Well, this is what they did. And we flew through the debris, and one bit of the debris came through the windscreen and shattered the windscreen. I couldn't see out it. It didn't actually shatter the windscreen, it exploded, but the lenses held together. Well, I then had to drive from the second dickey seat, which was just handy enough. And we were then at the top of our height, crossing the coast, going into France. We'd be about 10 to 12,000 feet, I suppose. And I panicked. I thought, oh gosh, I've been hit in the arm. And I could almost feel the blood sort of running down my arm here. I get out of here quick. And I stuffed the nose down. And I've never taken off so quickly in all my life before or since, except on the commercial flights. I went through my mind, oh gosh, you know, the policeman walking up the drive path to knock on the door, Mr. Sutherland, sorry, your lad's gone. And then I thought of Colin Rouse, my navigator. What about him? Oh gosh, he was going to get married to Kath. Oh God, poor Kath. And Nix's Margaret, she was waiting for him. Then there was Reggie. Reggie had already been married in Canada. Oh God, what would you do? And Bertie was already married, He was the other Australian. Nixon and Birdie were the Australians. What the heck would you do? And this went through my mind, and I was just stuffed the nose down. And Bertie piped up. He said, "Chief," he said, "are you all right?" I said, "Oh, yes, yes, of course, Bertie." And I thought, now, how can I pull myself out of this? And I remembered the instructor telling me at Tyree on Tiger Moths that if you put too much pressure on the control column, you'll bend it. And he said, to try and fly straight and level, you'd be down here. You'd never make it. And that went through my mind. So I put as much pressure as I dared to pull out of it. And I think we came very close to the ground, because in the length of that were these, we had 12 or 15 French paratroopers on board too, and a bit of gear that they would have dropped alongside them. Oh, crikey dicks. I pulled out of that. Then we got over. The airspeed indicator wouldn't work. The rev counter, two of the rev counters gave up the ghost, but the engines didn't. I was in fairly coarse pitch, which was a bit of a help. My God, it wasn't the aeroplane's fault. The aeroplane came out of it beautifully. You'd be absolutely surprised. So much so that we carried on. We leveled off and carried on, because we were allowed then to pick your own height to travel at over France. And I generally picked about 500 feet, because we dropped at 6. Well, we got over, and the dropping zone, my God, where is it? We're still looking for it. In the meantime, just as we approached for about the third time, there was a stream of little lights coming up the road. There was about 20 vehicles and convoy, and they were Germans, of course, and we'd crossed over a couple of times to make sure that we weren't making a mistake. I then realised that was a German convoy, and they would be pooping at us before we knew where we were. It was like shooting ducks in low wire wrapper.
Yes, yes.
So I said to the bloke, called him up, I said, "Look, there's a convoy coming up there. You'll be shot down before you hit the ground." Mm. I said, we're not going to open up, and we're aborting the trip as of now. Now, I said, I got in ahead of him. He said, "We're not going back the way we came." I said, "No, that's right." I said, "We'll do something else." So I got onto the intercom to the navigator. I said, "Look, draw a line anywhere you like and tell him that's the line we'll cross. But if we do that, who takes the responsibility if, for instance, we get shot down by a place that's damn sight worse than where we came from?" So I decided we would go back the same way we came. And what had happened was that in the meantime, the Havre had been the target for a bombing raid, and they were busy cleaning up the mess from the bombing raid, and they never fired a shot when we went back over them. I almost laughed, except for the fact that the moment that we got over the boundary onto the North Sea of the English Channel, a motor packed up. A Conrod had come adrift had taken out the cylinder, and that closed the whole whole motor down. So then I had three motors with 15 paratroopers and their gear on board. Now what do I do? We were halfway over the channel. I thought, well, it's near enough to being close enough for me. I'll call up base and tell them to be prepared for, you know, three-engine landing, which I did. They said, look, we've got 100% fog all over the south part of England. Yeah. He said, if you can find an aerodrome anywhere, land on it, which is what we did. So the south coast was clear for about, I don't know, the bit that I was on was clear for about 10 miles in. And within that range, there was a fighter aerodrome. We came in, we made a landing, and the rules, good God, the rules were that we were to speak to no one. The only person that could have a communication with anybody on the ground was myself. So we landed, and it was now breakfast time, because it had taken us, we were fair way out.
Yes, yeah.
I don't know, it was about seven hours or so, and we'd been awake from breakfast time the same day. Mm. Oh, I complained to the Air Vice Marshal about that. I said, look, we need a second dickie. If we're going to do this, we need to have a co-pilot. And there were dozens of them. They were just more or less idle. And they had been very good. No, it didn't happen. And I was only a flight sergeant. So that was the dicey do, because 4 o'clock in the afternoon, they gave us breakfast, which was bacon and eggs and things we hadn't seen for long enough, and piles of sugar, cereal for breakfast. The fighter boys, that's what they lived on. And we had white sheets and white pillowcases. These blokes, the paratroopers, you should have heard the comments they were making. God, they said, this is luxury. Well, so, they finished up, they were so tired, because they'd been going most of the day too. They came down with a convoy to take them back. Humber Snipes, Humber Snipes station wagons. And there were about six or eight of those came down, and they took them back to London.
How many hours did you do flying in the war?
Oh, I didn't do very many. Just under 1,000.
Oh, yes, that's quite a lot of active hours, isn't it?
The thing was, we were just like that. You only had one target, one aeroplane, and you had 20 minutes when you got there. The flexibility of getting there and what have you. Now, the underground were very, very good to us in a way, because at a later stage, we were coming into the Japanese war when the European was over, and I had occasion to be going down and we were building up stores on the way to India to have a go. And we were taking gliders, and the rule was that you had to have a 100% performance from your aeroplane before you got to the English coast. We got just to the English coast, and a motor packed in. And I said to the boys, will we carry on with three engines? because the glider could cut himself off any time he wanted to, and he could land in a very small space. But we couldn't, and we would be pleased if we ran into trouble, we would need to drop him anyway. Oh yes, okay. Well, we took the risk. And we had some of the ground crew were in the glider. Well, we got down to Estrée, which is just over the swampy area behind Marseille. We got down there and of course we couldn't take off because we only had three engines. You know so. We were there for about 4 or 5 days, and each morning the underground would come around with they had a pilot Ford, and they had a Citroen convertible, and they took the crew. I had to stay to public relations, I suppose, just in case our head office rang. But they entertained the crew magnificently. Yes. And we went out to the movies one Saturday night to Avignon. And of course it was all in French. And they had English conversions underneath.
So when did your war finish in England then?
It was 45. By that time, they had fired the gun, I think, at Hiroshima, and that war was over fairly quickly. Then they said, well, now, do you want to take up commercial flying? And I said, yes. So many guys had said yes, and at this stage of the game, they promoted me to officer rank through no fault of my own, nor the crew. There came to be a Mark V Stirling, and it was a civilian, rigged up for civilian flying, distance and everything, and new. Man spanking. Oh, well, we'll see what you like for passenger flying. So with the Stirling 4, we got them at Cobbery by then, the Stirlings and me. I got a bit confident too, I suppose. So they gave me a test to see if I was good enough to apply the skills for passenger flying. And I read the rules, and yeah, they were pretty simple. Well, I got my lift to passenger flying. Oh, that's a great, yes, great achievement. Oh, well, we'll put you onto the Stirling 5s. Oh, well, now, you haven't been to India before, or at least you've only been once to India before. We'll take you out and show you a bit more. All right, so, flying officer, I've forgotten his name now, or flight lieutenant, rather, he'll show you the way, and you can share the flying. We got to Marseille again, and when we went across the Mediterranean into Tel Aviv airport, and then we went from there onto the, and it was my turn to fly from Tel Aviv into the Persian desert, a place called Shaiba. We landed there, and it was so hot, you weren't allowed to fly before 10 o'clock at night or 4 o'clock in the morning, at least between 10 and 4 you could fly.
That's right.
That's the only time you could. So we pulled in there and we all went through a bit of a routine. Refuel, that is the idea. Refuel so we got enough to get to India. My mate took over the flying. I got into a bunk because they had these civilian airliners, they were convertible bunks. Oh, it was delightful. Brand spanking new. Oh, God, everything worked. Marvellous. Okay. So he took off. Oh, about 10 minutes, quarter of an hour or so. On the radio. Oh, the undercart's not up. Hello? Oh, well, I'll give it another go. Right, so he pressed the button again and he still got a red light. This was coming up in the cockpit. Oh, and his flight engineer came along. Oh, he said, it's practically there. Oh, well, he said, just give it a bit of a manual pull. This had a very long handle on it. So he pushed it in, and this was now in our sight. We could see everything that was going on. So they got a hold of it. He said, I can't move it. Well, he said, get a hold of Noel's engineer and give it a good hard pull. Got to get it right. So the two of them got on this and they gave it a mighty bloody pull. Enough to strip the rod that was tying these things down that he wound it up on. When the rod stripped, the
wheels fell down.
The undercart weighed a half a ton anyway. Yes. At least the two undercarts weighed half a ton. There's the one of them, a quarter of it. Oh, huge! It went out through the roof.
Oh, joking!
Through the wing, and on the way out, it activated the automatic inflation for the dinghy.
Oh.
And the dinghy burst open and then it was in the slipstream. The engines were all right. It was in the slipstream and it burst. So that there was strings hanging out the back and this thing was sitting up here like that. And then all of a sudden it gave a drop, and it dropped about a third of the way down. His nibs up at the front said, oh, well, he said, and his engineer was talking to him. He said, it's dropped down about a third. Oh, wait a minute, he says, a bit more than that. It dropped a bit more. So he said, oh, well, look, he said, if one's down, he said, we'll put the other one down too. And I went through my mind that that's suicidal. So I said, well, look, I'm going up the front and I'm going to ask him if he'll drop us at 1,000 feet over the top of Shiber and then he can please himself what he does. And we talked it around.
Yes,
and this was a new crew to me.
Yes.
It wasn't my normal crew.
Yes.
New people altogether. I said, well, that's where I'm off to. And I just got myself ready to go, and he asked if I would come up to the top. So I'd gone through this process, the advantage of that. And he said, well, have you ever had anything like this before? I said, well, I suppose I have. And I don't know why I lied to him, because I had no reason to do that, but I'd worked it out what I would do. He said, well, he said, if you've done that, would you give me a hand? I said, no. I said, I'll give you a hand on one condition, and that is that I'm the skipper of the aeroplane. I'm in charge, I'm the captain of everything. Now, I said, you can talk to the control tower as much as you like, but I said, I'm doing the driving. Oh, yes, that's all right. Oh, thank God for that. So, first thing I did was I sacked his radio operator. I said, now look, you're going to do a thing that I would never ever think of doing. I said, you're going to go and you're going to lie down on the bunk and you're going to light a cigarette and you're going to smoke it. And you're going to relax. He was in a ball of sweat. He was sitting in a ball of sweat. He was just around the twist. So I got my bloke up and he took over. And I thought, well, now we got one leg down, one leg useless. What do you do? Well, you go through what you've been told, I suppose. Yeah. And the thing was that as soon as we got over the boundary fence, I kind of eased forward a bit, and I made bloody sure that I knocked that other one out.
Mm.
It was down. Mm. Yes, they were right. So he did that, and she just made the smoothest landing that you ever could think of. And just as it was really slowed right down, she turned about that much. Just a fraction, and it didn't do the slightest bit of harm. Except it stripped the undercard, of course, was buggered. Well, that was the first of the Mark V's, new aeroplane altogether, and I think that would have been one of the last ones.
Mm. And so, as a result of that flight, did they pass you for? Why?
No thanks for it at all.
Nothing.
No.
Why?
They weren't interested in that.
Was it because of the attitude of the chap you replaced?
I would have said at least thank you. It was funny because when the aircraft stopped and slightly turned, there's a gadget up here that you put your hand on and you pull that down, and that gives you the chance to get out the top. Well, I went to make sure that the ignition was off and the petrol was off and all the emergency things that the fire extinguishers on and everything else. Mm. And I looked around and God, his seat was empty. He's gone. So I opened up this top, and it was then only just a small drop from here to three or four feet drop, and down below was a bloke holding a fire hose. And I'd said to him, you know, if we peed together, we would have a bit more power on behind it than you've got. He said, I know. He said, that hasn't come on yet. In the meantime, the two crews and helpers and fire crew, they formed a chain from the aeroplane and took out personal bits and pieces. And then all of a sudden, the power came on the hose that he was holding and went over the top of the wing, and it washed everybody who was in the queue. I haven't stopped laughing ever since. It was a ball. But then the next thing I knew, I was on the way home.
When you came home then, Noel, did you go back to university or had you finished university?
No, I hadn't finished university, but I then joined the soil conservation outfit, and they had a bit of fun.
Now, originally you started in Kurau.
Quite so, yeah. My uncle had a farm up the Hakataramea Valley, and I spent a lot of time up there. But oh gosh, the rabbits were... We had a carrying capacity of about 2,800 odd ewes. They were half-breds. That wasn't the capacity, really, if you didn't have any rabbits. And that capacity got down to slightly above 2,000, and that made the difference. And there were two blokes who came up, and for 3 months in the winter, they took 22,000 rabbits off 1,500 acres. Well, I had a job taking the stores out to the blokes who were rabbit-proofing the back fence. I used to go out, the stores truck didn't arrive until about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I took off, about three-ish, went on the trail. I always had two dogs with me, because one I could send home and one would stay with me if the horse happened to play up. So we were walking along on a place that had quite a good covering of topsoil. It was very quiet, very quiet. And then round the corner, it was shingle. And on this occasion, it was a lovely moonlight night. It was August in the school holidays. And around the corner, the horse's hoof struck a rock, and that was enough to set the rabbits going. And about 15 or 20 of them ran into each other. They were so thick on the ground.
Right.
And one night I counted about 15 or 20 black ones. We had the odd yellow one, and we had, there were two or three whites around.
Goat, yeah.
And there was a white hare on the other side of the road, and it used to, when it heard the vibration of the horse was coming, it used to crouch down so that it couldn't be seen. And you could, from the height of the horseback, you could see this. And you called the dogs off, and the sheep dogs wouldn't chase a rabbit, and the rabbit dogs wouldn't chase a sheep. They were gotten onto that very readily. Well, this night, the rabbits were tumbling over each other. Now, not too many, but there were some. And that was a thing that was news to me.
And so how long were you in Kurau?
Oh, I went there for school holiday.
And so for then, when you started full-time with the department, where did you start?
No, my father had a job then at Darfield in Canterbury, and I was at university, at least, yes, that's right. But after the war, I got a job, because I didn't have a job.
Yes.
And I had a health problem that I found it very difficult to sit down as we're doing now. And I couldn't even sit in the car. And I had to go to the hospital in Oamaru three times a week from Duntroon. We were staying with my uncle and aunt. That was very difficult, very, very difficult. So I took on this soil conservation job, and that meant going to Lincoln for 6 months. We had a high pressure course, and there was seven on the course, six return blokes and one follow. And he's the only one that's alive now.
Oh,
and,
really?
And myself.
And yourself.
Yes. And I'm in contact with him in Canada.
He well, went that's over wonderful.
To the
yes.
Canadian Rehabilitation Forest, doing a similar kind of a thing, but the different environment.
When you'd finished at Lincoln, where did you start your field work with the department?
I was posted to Masterton. Story there, first of all, one of the things was that there was no authority for burning off grass or scrub. The Forest Service were responsible for any fires in the forest, but they had a limit to two chains outside the forest so they could protect the forest. And I couldn't help but get the impression that they weren't very keen on the native forests. They were keener on the planted forest, and that was proven around Taupo. We went on a firefighting course at just out of Taupo, over the river from Wairu. And the one-stroke method was the method to be using to meet the fire. Well, at a later stage, when I was in the Wairarapa, and subsequently in Wellington, I had 10 years in the field and 10 years in head office. And I had separately 10 years in agriculture department and 20 years in ministry works. So they were split. So we came under different kinds of management and different histories. And I had my job was preparation of the soil conservation part of the agenda, the soil conservation.
Oh, right.
And that covered the whole of New Zealand, and to some extent we had an inspectorial arrangement there. I should mention that amongst the when I referred to the fire business earlier, the only authority that there was for other than life being threatened or buildings was in fact the catchment boards. You see, the
yes.
county would be responsible for life and building per se, but any other fire that was not controlled at all.
Mm.
I give top marks to the people whom I shared the training with at Lincoln. They first of all got to know what they were doing, and then they had to talk to farmers, because in the summertime, and that applied to Hawke's Bay as well as the Wairarapa, to Canterbury, to Otago, in particular, and the Manawatu. The burning was such that the sun was a dull orange in
yes.
the middle of the day, and that was not restricted. And Bryant and May had the name of being one of the main items of use to set light to the
fire in
the summertime. I have trailed on a horse with soaked in kerosene trail, and you drive and get the biggest fire that you can. And I used to be able to strike a match on the trousers and have it in the tussock before the head had, the phosphorus of the head had gone out. So I'd had some experience there of doing the wrong thing, but with the rabbits it was awkward. very, very awkward because the rabbits would eat anything, and even the weeds that grew, the flat weeds that grew, the rabbits would eat that too. And the greatest difficulty was the wind-blown faces where the topsoil is very small, and the back faces had overly large topsoil. The grass grew here that was not eaten because they were eating the fresh stuff here. Then when I got to Palmerston North, we took a keen interest in grasslands division. They had measured, cut and measured the grass growth in a where there was a concentration of animals. And on one occasion, Eddie Suckling was the promoter in the field, and he measured grass growth equivalent to 28 head of cattle of sheep, and we reckoned that if you could split that up a bit, you'd get better growth more evenly, and you'd start to move into farming proper. And that was borne out by Hugh Morrison of Tanui Way in Masterton. During the period between the First War and the Second, there was a depression, and the local fellow who was the headmaster of the school didn't work, and he was put on shorter hours, and Hugh Morrison got him to put a clock, an alarm clock, on the gatepost of the paddock, and that was to allow the grazing to go on for 20 minutes in the morning and 20 minutes in the afternoon, and then the stock were driven off and they were taken up onto the easy hills that he had. With that transference of fertilizer, of what turned out to be fertilizer, that was a winner. And he started to increase the growth up here, and he got into some tiger country that he was only running dry stock on, and he managed to do that. That is the principle of rotational grazing, and that's what we have our socks on. And we found a bloke, Linklater, at Pohongara. He did a similar kind of thing, and that stimulated the soil conservation use of the manipulation of the grazing animal. I should say this about the time in the Wairarapa, at least the time in Manawatu, and it applied also to just around Dannevirke here, similar types of soil, or the soil and the stuff that the rock that was underneath there made a big, big difference. Because sand, pumice sand, pumiceous sand, existed over in the Wairarapa, and in fact, if you have a look at the bench, on top of what might be, you'd think was mud or mudstone, that was in places so steep, they were protected really by being steep, because they couldn't stand being either windblown or rainblown. You'd see the pinnacles, the summit Otumatata in the South Island, the summit Palliser Bay down here, and where one stone on top of a column of this roof will really form a spire, and they get 8, 10, 20 feet high.
So when you left Palmerston North and Masterton, somewhere you must have got married.
Palmerston North. Okay. I'll tell you a story about the Palmerston North one. There's one place there of 575 acres. He had a mile and a quarter of cavern cutting through the stuff on top, and it was about 150 feet to the ground. The wind blew, nor'wester, and it started to blow the sand with a heavy wind, and it formed little micro dunes on the top side. We had an Australian assistant to Dr. Bennett, whose Bible we used a large amount in the American chief soil conservator. And I said to him, "What would you do if you were here?" "Well," he said, "it's a bit like this," he said. "I have no experience of this at all. But," he said, "what I would do would be I'd put a track in the top end here," and he said, "I'd collect $5 from everybody who's in the car who's driven down and had a look at it." He said, "That would be the solution I would put on it." And I thought, if that's coming from the world's number two, what are we doing? Now, in one occasion, in one night, there was a fairly big rainstorm on this pumice sand, and it missed the house by about 100 yards, but it cut a hole. The next morning I went out, and the fence was up here, about 40 or 50 feet, just cut it straight through because it found a weakness, and it once it started to cut, of course, it was just like soup.
Yes, that's
at
right.
The bottom end, and as far as I know, it's still there.
Coming back to Palmerston North,
yes,
you married Margaret.
Yes.
And how many children?
Two boys. Yes.
No daughters.
No. No, I left that to the great-grandchildren, yeah.
Some stage you left Palmerston North and yes, came to live in...
I went to Wellington to do a tour in head office, and also I finished my degree there.
That was a degree in
geology.
Geology, yes.
Yeah, no, that was very useful to me because... And I've got some samples that I was mainly on the east coast, but samples that I've got are of mainly of mudstones, and we identified one mudstone from another, from another, from another, and it proved really a little bit like they wanted me to have a go at connate water, which is moisture that has been trapped for millions of years. Mm. I had a family, they were young, and I couldn't give up, I'd have to give up work to do it. So I didn't. The beauty of this was that the understanding of pressure, that was exemplified by when John Porter and his mates found a place down in Central Hawke's Bay, Christmas time.
Mm.
So the guy went up to the wool shed make sure that the water supply was on and everything was right. Oh, and very good. So away he went. He came back again about a fortnight or 3 weeks. And he came to where he'd stopped before. And holy smokes, he had the brakes on. She dropped about 100 feet. Now, this was at a time when there was no rain whatsoever over Christmas and New Year. But the whole face had moved down, and there was about 20 acres in terms of having a look at it. And there's another 10 or so acres down below where the topsoil had boulded up. Why should that happen when there was no storm? There was no reason for it.
There's obviously underground water, isn't there?
Correct. And that was proven when the same sort of thing happened down at Tiapiti Road down here at Waimarama. The pressure, the weight, the deep-seated pressure had come on and had pushed the mud up the top. And it didn't stop, and it kept flowing.
Yes. Amazing.
And there was no rain at all, and there was no way of controlling it. Now, that happened up in Gisborne, at Ahernia Valley, at Ahernia Station. It was just, and the slope had little or nothing to do with it. Absolutely remarkable. Mm. And, of course, down at just below Potongara. They mined it. They're still mining it. And they've been using it in medication for stock food so that they could... It's so slippery that they could use it as a base for their for stock.
That's not bentonite, is it?
Yeah, that's right.
It is bentonite. That's right. Yes. Oh, so then when you...
That's stollards.
Yes. So then you moved to Hawke's Bay. From Wellington you came to Hawke's Bay and worked with the department for 20 years.
Oh, yes.
And you lived in Selwyn Road for that time. Your children grew up
born there.
And then your interest in conservation up the East Coast all developed during that time.
It's very interesting because from time to time I took some of the students from Woodford House on a trip to the coast, and the different types of erosion that occur along that road is remarkable. Absolutely remarkable.
Well, I've fished the Ruakaturi Valley for many, many years.
Yeah.
The Hungaroa, through Waimaha Station up to the Huias, Waikaramoana, and they all have those huge mudstone slides. They have that huge pressure ridge that drove everything up in a certain direction.
New Zealand has got a whole host of situations. The deposits on the Wither Hills in Lenham, they were all aerial born, which means that there was a big dry patch of land over out in the Tasman, and it got whipped across from there to there. And we had a bulldozer that was lost down one of the sinkholes.
So now, when you're in Hawke's Bay, you did quite a lot of work with erosion control using trees, undergrazing of trees, didn't you?
We got into some sorts of things. We thought we had onto a deterrent for stock wanting to eat them. John Porter, when he got the idea that the Lombardy trees that we used here could well be used for planting and striking and growing on the hill. And obviously the better the soil, the better the growth. But by the same token, these things were very versatile. And in fact, we started up with Chris Van Cronord at Tongoyo, and he finished up at Cowtree. We had a research area at Cowtree, and we built on millions of tissue culture, and that worked very, very well, except that when I was in the Hakataramea Valley on the Kirkleston Range, you used to be able to see in the summertime the remnants of the snow were covered with the ash from the fires in Australia. And Australia, that stage of the game, had an outbreak of disease that attacked the new growth on poplars. And Bryant and May were using Australia's for growing these things. They were so impressed with the growth rates that we get here in Hawke's Bay that they either acquired or had the lease of some land at Miani, and they grew their own, because we were putting on roughly an inch a year. Now, that stuff was, and they were taking that and splitting it into matches. Well, it got so bad that we couldn't help but get some coming across the sea. It's a microscopic pollen.
It's like a rust, isn't it?
Yeah, Molybdenum. Yeah,
because the Chinese poplar is the only one that doesn't get it. Unithinthus.
Yes.
You were known as the district conservator.
Yeah, that's right. That included the Gisborne area as well.
That's right, Gisborne East Coast.
Yes.
Was there anything else you can think of that you did that was different within the department? The river control was with the catchment boards, wasn't
it? Yes, that's right. There were two blokes, one did the North Island, one did the South, senior engineers in Wellington. And but mostly the engineering was done executives for the catchment boards.
Yes.
And the soil conservator was sort of an add-on.
Yes.
But increasingly, when we got into gear, things moved a wee bit more smoothly, wider. For instance, aerial top dressings. And I can tell you a fair story about that.
Community service, you were a member of Rotary, you still are a member of Rotary.
Yes.
And of course, Margaret was ill, and
she was teaching in Wellington. She was teaching at a satellite school to the Gandalas. She was asked by the one principal teacher. He said, "Look, there's more kids here than I can handle. How about you having a go?" So she did. And we got friendly with some people who had a lad about the same size and age of our youngest. And she said, "Well, look, if you could teach the 20 or 30 kids that you've got," she said, "and you have to stay at home to look after your kids," she said, "I'll take him, because my kid's got to be taught as well. So she became great friends, and Margaret made a bit of history there. She carried on to the extent that when we came to Hawke's Bay, we went and had a look at what the possibilities were of Havelock North, including the churches, and good appreciation of religion here. Swimming, there's a bit of good appreciation. Teaching, well, just Tamata School had an orchard within view of the school boundary, and it's so attractive. And it has a good climate. I think it's got the best climate in New Zealand. That's not the reason for my having to move out. But yes, we've got onto that one. Margaret made quite a good friends with the Rotary hands who were in the inner wheel, and she kept that going for a while.
Rotary as well, you're still an honorary member since you retired from Rotary?
Well, it wasn't my fault, but...
I know.
When I came here first, I worked in Napier as Ministry of Works. At least we worked in agriculture in Hastings. Then it became Napier because we changed back to Ministry Works from agriculture. I didn't know anybody who was in Havelock North. And I thought, well, Rotary's got a wide range of activities. I made friends enormously. Through Rotary, I got to know how the place ticked a wee bit more. I've got one little one to tell you. To give you an idea how we spent our time, Masterton, the Wairarapa, I had a call to go to see someone on the coast. We went down, they said, well, now look, if you're going to come this far, could you possibly bring a passenger? I said, oh, no, that'll be all right. They said, well, it's the piano tuner. And I said, oh, well, that's okay. So I said, well, I'll pick him up about 7 in the morning, and it'll take us a while to get there, but I'll give you a ring from a little place I know, not far away, and let you know when we're there so that you can bring the horses across and we're right. So we started off at about 7:30. Oh, he said, you work for Soils. Yes, I said, oh, I do a bit. And he said, why aren't we on bicycles? Because Gibson Rayside had just done the soils of Lower Wairarapa. Yes. Oh, I said, it's a bit too long for that. Oh, well, he said, that'll be all right. We plodded on, and of course in those days the cars didn't travel very fast. 40 miles an hour was at the limit. We got to this little place with the telephone. I said, I'll be probably about 10 minutes. So I rang up and I said, well, we're on our way. You've got to probably got a half an hour or so to get the horses over or so. But and I didn't know what I was talking about either. Never been there before. So we got going, and we found that we were in a one-way track, and it was cut under a cliff. And there'd been a bit of a rain the day or so before, and there was a little bit of a trickle coming down the top and over the road and then down. He said, what did you ring for? I said, oh, just to give them some advance notice that we're on our way, and they'll bring the horses over. Horses? Horses? He said, what are they for? Oh, I said, we'll need the horses to get over the creek. Oh, I said, have you ever ridden a horse? No, never ridden a horse. Well, I said, you've got to be educated. Oh, we came to this bit that was trickling across the road. Oh, he said, we can step over that. I said, yeah, that's right, I said. But I said, the bit that we've got to get across is that bit down there. And it was the tidal entrance from the river, an exit from the river. I said, that's the bit we've got to get. God, he says. Oh, he said, I don't know about that. Oh, I said, it's too late now, lad, it's too late. So I left him trembling a wee bit. The bloke brought over three of his staff, came over with him. They tried to get this fellow right. They had a loading bank, fortunately. And they said to him, now, you sit as though you're sitting in an armchair at home, because that's the way you sit on a saddle. So they sat him, got him, he was stiff.
Yes.
And there's no quicker way to fall off a horse is to be stiff. So they finished up, there was one bloke here and one bloke there, and the boss bloke, and they brought a horse over for me. And those horses just about knew every stone they stood on.
Yes.
And he was trembling, he was really. Never seen a bloke so scared. And we got over the other side, and that was fine. He couldn't get off the horse quick enough. They had a loading bank there too. We went up and did the job we had to do, and then they said, oh, well, they gave us a bite of lunch before we left. And as soon as he hit the ground, he couldn't get into the house quick enough, and the piano became alive.
Is that right?
Oh, God, yes. So he spent the rest of the afternoon, or the morning and the afternoon, tuning the piano, and we got back about 3:30. They said, look, we've got my cousin here, a youngster from school. I don't suppose you can take her back when you go back. Oh, I said, that's all right, that's okay. So by the time we got down to the river again, the moon was just floating out here in the east, and it was calm as could be, and you could hardly hear the splash of the horses' hooves. Oh, it was absolutely awe-inspiring. I had the girl's suitcase in front of me, and we finished up, but once again, it took a wee while to get home.
Yes.
And then I didn't have the guts at 9:30 at night to say, we should have done that with a bike.
A good finish to the story. Thank you, Noel.